All right, we're going to edit out us talking shit. But
hey, I already ate one twin. I can eat the other.
Hey guys, it's T. I'm going to be joined tonight by my friends Ian and Emily, or as I refer to them, my Boston shithead wonder twins, which is a name that they actually came up with themselves. I didn't start calling them shithead wonder twins, but they have embraced it with glee, and I love them for it. You can find me on Tumblr at Law School Ruined Me, or on Twitter at MyJDRuinedMe, because Twitter is great and doesn't let me use my full handle. We're going to be talking tonight about crafting and the joy of making something with your hands when you spend all of your day staring at a computer screen and wondering why you paid so much money for degrees that would just eventually ruin your eyesight.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ian, one of the Boston Wonder Twins. You can find me on Tumblr at Lawblow with Alcohol.
My name is Emily, and you can find my shitpost Twitter at MLEDAYC. You can find me on Instagram at EMDAYC. And because I am the epitome of a cliche, I am Lady Justice on Discord, all one word. And you can find me on Tumblr with the handle that I made when I was 15, which is Emily and the Machine. I would change it, but then someone else might take it. And I can't let that happen.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Warhammer?
Sure. So for all the listeners and for T, who are not total nerds, geeks, and, you know, go down the rabbit hole of 80s sci-fi, Warhammer 40,000 is a tabletop war game from the UK. It's set in the year 40,000, and it's an incredibly dark setting. I mean, like, there's quite literally no good guys. The human faction is a fascist theocracy where they will quite literally kill the entire population of a planet if they suspect that somebody who's a traitor is on the planet.
Going straight to the nuclear option. Okay.
Yeah, it's called Exterminatus, and it's a last resort, but it's on the table. And everything is geared towards war and military. And you would think, okay, so there must be some other good guys. No. The orcs are a species that are always trying to fight somebody and shoot people and chop them in half with what they call choppers and sluggers.
Very creative names.
Yeah. Oh, and when they get to be an important enough orc, they get to have the big shooters and, you know, the stompers. And like, it's meant to be a parody and a joke. And it's a great setting. They can do a lot of fun with it. And when you get to the tabletop, that's represented by models. So these models are like an airplane kit where they come on a plastic sprue. You clip them apart. You shape them a little bit with a paring knife, maybe. You glue them together, and suddenly you have a 3D model that you can paint. And then you can play games with it. And so my hobby is the building, painting, and playing with little toy war dollies.
And I think you had told me that one of the rules of the game is that you have to have, like, crafted and painted to be able to play them on the table. Like, you can't just buy it and say, well, here's my unpainted one, and I'm going to play it today.
Yep. So they actually made a change with the most recent edition of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And out of the 100 points that you can score while playing a game, 10 of them are for being fully painted. 10% of your ability to win the game is based on, do you have things painted to at least a minimum standard? Like, you don't have to be, you know, trying to compete for best painted. But what used to happen is people would, you know, build it, get a spray can, and just spray them black, and that would be all they would do. And now I'm traveling an hour and paying money to play in an event, and my opponent shows up with a bunch of just primed black models. It's kind of boring. It's not really interesting to see on the table.
Right, and I guess, like, part of what you would want from this type of game is, like, you want to be participating in a bit of an immersion experience. Like, the one that you just showed me had a lot of detail to it. Like, there was, yeah, so you've colored the armor in a couple different colors. There's, like, detail upon the shield that he has. There's a variety of, like, it looks like, oh, even his sword is like a light blue compared to the dark blue. Yeah. And you've done the detailing on the metallurgy as well too. So there's a lot in there. Like, I can really picture this guy in a battle scenario.
Yep. So there's a variety of techniques that I use for this in a variety of paints. And they all kind of work together. So, you have base paints, which are your big blocky colors. You have what are called wash paints or oil paints, and they're very thin down, and their job is to get in the recesses and add shadows and depth. And then you have dry brushes and layer paints, which add lighter colors to the raised edges to kind of really make it come alive. And then you can even do stuff where you have like technical paints, which you noticed on the spear I showed you, it had this kind of real gradient effect, and that's because it's got some viscosity.
Oh, okay.
And that viscosity allows it to pool in one area, but pull away from the edge. And so all my edges look kind of raised and sharper and lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And the flat edges look pooled and darker. So it creates like a power field effect.
Yeah, it actually almost reminded me of like the energy swords in the Halo game.
And that's what it's supposed to do. That's the exact effect I'm going for. And I mean, that's a pretty standard model that I've done some. It's called kit bashing, where I take bits from one kit and mix them with another to make it more personal. And so a big thing, especially for a gamer like me, is what standard we paint it up to. And so a big thing is, you know, you want to get to a tabletop standard, which is, does it look good from 3 feet away?
Okay.
Because you're a 5.5 foot to 6.5 foot person. You're at a 6x4 foot table. You want to be able to see the models and make them out and have everything kind of be distinct at that distance.
Right.
Whereas other people who are painting for competitions can go into some, I mean, they get, you know, magnoculars with bright lights on them, and they go for layer paint and gradually getting it better and better, because they inspect their models from 6 inches away and really catch all those details. That's not what I do. I'm there to get them on the table and make them look good and get that immersion effect, but not really go much further than that.
Right, because I mean, at a certain point, you do recognize that it's a hobby rather than a professional calling. And I think that when we do craft work, there is a certain amount of, I just want it to be fun, versus this has to be so perfect that nobody else could ever judge me on it. So, how did you get into this originally?
So, the town I live in has several train stops. And I was getting off one during law school, and I thought I knew the way home from this train stop. I did not. So, I took a wrong turn and walked past the storefront, and then walked into the store. And so I got into this hobby because I took a wrong turn.
This is the most ADHD story you've told me so far.
The store manager loves on Saturdays when people ask me, so how'd you get into this? Oh, I took a wrong turn.
He's like, He saw my storefront.
He absolutely loves the way I phrase that, because people are always taken aback. I'm like, no. I really enjoy this. It's not a bad thing. It's just, I was supposed to go left, I went right at the Y, and here I am 5 years later.
It was a wrong turn geographically, not like in my life's journey.
Exactly. But I mean, you know me, you know I love good turns of phrase and being able to make a joke and a bit of wordplay, so.
So how do you decide what, like, where you start with a new project with this? Is it like you take each piece and you can create a new one to add to your collection? Do you do it in like a set? How does that work when you approach the project?
So, like I mentioned earlier, there are different factions which relate to different armies. And so your first army, what you typically do is rule of cool it, which means I walked in and the guy explained different armies to me, and he said, and these guys are the space wolves, space werewolf Vikings. They have anti-authoritarian issues, and they love to take hammers and bash people over the head.
And you were like, sold.
I was like, sold. That's what we are doing. Space werewolf Vikings with authority issues. And so, I mean, there were like 26 factions with a lot of sub-factions and like background lore. So it's pretty easy to find a faction that has some theme that you like for your first army. And that's what we usually recommend people to do because you spend a lot of time painting.
Mm-hmm.
So to get to a what would be considered a normal game of Warhammer 40,000, it takes 2,000 points of models, which typically translates to about $750 to $850 worth of stuff.
Oh my goodness.
And that's just the raw kits. From there, it takes another $100 of clippers, knives, glue, paints, brushes to build the stuff and paint it. And all the man hours.
Yeah, and that's not even counting your hourly rate.
So this hobby has an incredibly high entry point. But things get cheaper as they go on. Well, I should say, things become more efficient as you use them more.
Right, and part of it, I'm sure, is that there's, like, you do a lot of initial costs if you are getting the tools in which to take apart, build the kits, and, like, the paint brushes and stuff like that.
I would say probably 20 paints on average for a normal, for what would be considered a normal model is about what you can expect.
Are you using the full pot, or is it like we're using 20 different?
Nothing like that. You're using, you know, a little bit of the pot, and then you have the pot for the next model and the next model. But you still need to get the pot to have that little bit for your first model. And so it's just, it's easily $1,000. It could be $1,000 of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Just to get, and then the rule books, each rule book is $50.
It's so funny to compare this, which is a very, like, game dude-oriented hobby, to something like cross-stitching or crochet, where it's like, if you just want to do a one-time project, you go to Michael's, you spend $10, and you've got all the equipment to do it.
No, this isn't. I mean, they have, like, miniature kits where they'll sell, like, 7 paints that go together color-wise. And, you know, starter kits that are a little bit discounted. But there's really no dabbling. The best you can get for dabbling is you buy your own kit and you have a friend who does it. And you borrow all of their stuff.
Right.
And then it's a $50 kit that you build and you paint and you see, do I like this? Do I want to keep doing this? But then your friend's going to say, hey, back off, and this is all my stuff. I spent money on my paints and everything. I need to keep it for me.
I have a high paid up capital in this.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, and then you get I like, this is like $5 and it's 1/3 of a blanket.
Yeah. And then you get to like the extra fun stuff, which is, for instance, listeners, you can't see this, but this guy, because my army has a lot of options for weapon choice, I magnetized it. And so magnets are not part of the company's model. They don't sell magnets, but I found magnets on my own and used super glue to attach them. And so now I have magnets with extra weapon options that I painted and salvaged from other kits.
So you effectively MacGyvered your army to give them more what looked like Wolverine claws.
Yes, what they're called, lightning claws. they have a lot of fun names. They have a lot of fun names in this game. You know, they know how to sell it. They have lightning claws, thunder hammers, doom scythes. Like, there's a lot of fun names in this game. And as much as I can, I'm cheap. I know I just spent time telling you how expensive this hobby is, but
yeah, you did. You just did just tell me how much money you must have spent when you were in fucking law school to get into this hobby. Okay, if we let Ian, he would just talk forever about Warhammer until we finally got to, like, hey, did you know that Superman does it? So,
I know, though. So it's like a thing that Joe Manganiello does, plays D&D, and he's like really fucking into D&D. Are there any notable people to Warhammer?
Yes, Henry Cavill.
Oh my god, T, that means literally Superman plays Warhammer.
I know, that's why I said it.
Yep, so Henry Cavill, I don't know if anyone follows him. I don't have Instagram or Twitter, but he did a tour of the factory and like the Warhammer World museum that they have, which is really cool to see as a nerd, because we all know he plays, because he mentions it like, you know, on the sly. And then I get bombarded by messages from all my friends and family like, wait, you people do this. This isn't just like something that people do in their basements. This is like respectable adults. And I'm like, yes. To afford this hobby, you generally have to be a respectable adult. Most of the guys I game with are lawyers, PhDs, masters, business owners. Like,
this is not Magic the Gathering. We've got it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And, you know, it's just a bunch of, I see what you're saying. It's just a bunch of stressed out people and high demanding professional jobs who like to hang out, talk nerd shit, and sniff super glue.
Yes, we do have to work on the ventilation. That's a problem for a lot of us.
So, Emily, tell us what kind of craft work you like to do.
So, I mean, there are things that I really enjoy, but I would say the primary thing is jewelry making. My mom, I think I remember her showing me how to like, make snowflakes and make paper fans. And I remember showing me how to curl ribbon with scissors when I was 4, which, you know, great move. We had this big party and the centerpieces, which in retrospect were super problematic, don't call PETA, were ivy bowl, like ivy fish bowls with betta fish in them. And my mom decorated these bowls with like a cute little satin ribbon and a satin flower on them. And she was decorating them and I was in the living room just like watching her bake them and fascinated. And I got up to go to the bathroom and I tripped and stepped on the hot glue gun barefoot.
Oh no.
Yeah. So I was like 7 at that point. And
survived the scissors at 4, but not the hot glue gun itself.
I don't even know how to describe how painful it was. Like, I couldn't walk for a few days. I was kind of scared to get back into crafting for a while. It just turned into just this fear, like, I'm going to cut myself on scissors. I can't go near a hot glue gun. I'm going to hurt myself. And I didn't really do much until my senior year of high school. My mom took me to the craft store. She's like, okay, you know, pick out the beads you want. If you're saying you're going to make your jewelry, you're going to make your jewelry. Like, you got to commit to this if I'm paying for the supplies. So I took maybe like half a day and I was sketching out designs and I ended up making earrings and a bracelet. They were what really got me to think like, huh, maybe I'm actually decent at this. And then that following summer, after I graduated high school, a friend and I, we're going to set up an Etsy shop and we're going to sell stuff. This is how we're going to make money in college. But you kind of, it's sort of like getting an Instagram following. Like, it's so hard to have an Etsy shop take up, you know, up off the ground. I mean, even now, by the time this comes out, I'll have things up. There's no traffic on mine. And I think my skills have gotten a lot better since then. So after that, after spending a lot of money on like beads and wire and stuff like that, I kind of put it on hold until I was going into my second year of law school and my friend worked at Joann's. So I was going there a lot and I bought a bunch of beads on clearance and I was broke as a joke, like so, so broke. And I felt badly because I was like, I don't know how I'm going to be able to buy people Christmas gifts. And I had all of these beads, like, okay, I'm going to sell them. And my mom took me to get my hair done when I finished finals, just as a, you know, a congratulations. And I happened to be wearing a pair of earrings that I'd made. And my hairstylist, who's been doing my hair since I was 7, said, oh, look, those are so pretty. Where'd you get those? And, oh, I made them. She's like, you make jewelry? I said, yeah, it's just, you know, something that I do for fun. And she said, you know, if you want, you can put up a display here and I'll sell them for you. So I cranked out a bunch of stuff and I put them on a display and I dropped them off. And she said, come back in a month or two and I'll give you the net profit. And just from me bringing that stuff there, I got like $200.
And I was at least able to get, you know, small things, you know, some gifts for my siblings who are 15 and 17 years younger than I am.
How did you find time to crank all of that out in 2L?
It was, I mean, that's a really good point. I didn't sleep. I think the answer is that I didn't sleep. And I think I was just going into hyper-focus mode. I would come back from class and I would be just incredibly stressed out by everything that was going on, stressed out about finals. So I would study and then I would be so high strung that I needed to find a way to just turn it off. And with the type of person that I am, that means I need to do something that involves very specific focus and being able to be like, okay, I'm going to put this bead here and this bead here, and maybe I'm going to go with this color. This is the length I'm going to do. It just calms me down. It always has. You know, any type of crafting. I'm really into florals. I thought about doing florals on the side once, but you have to go to school to be a florist.
That's crazy, but I guess that makes sense. Like the whole living thing side of it.
And yeah, about you making sure they don't wilt or die. So I actually did the flowers for my friend's wedding a few years ago, and I'm doing the flowers for my own in July. Apologize for getting sidetracked. So yeah, that was winter of 2L. And then I got engaged right before I graduated, 2 days before law school graduation. And then lockdown came around and looking everywhere for the perfect headpiece. I didn't want anything that was too tiara-ish, but I didn't want anything that was just a headband. And I wanted it to have that iridescent aurora borealis look to it. And I couldn't find one anywhere. And I said, screw it. I'm going to learn how to make essentially a tiara. And I looked up tutorials on how to do it. And most of it involved soldering. So melting metal. I'm like, all right, I can learn how to solder. So
gone through law school. I can learn how to do anything.
Well, that was big. I'm through law school. Everything had shut down. This was 2 weeks after I'd taken the bar exam, and I knew that I needed to distract myself from thinking about getting my scores back, because I didn't pass the first time I took the bar, and that waiting period between taking the exam and waiting for your scores just made me go crazy. So we were locked down. My hours got cut at work. Sam was out of work. And I just needed something else to focus on. And so that meant that I was binging Avatar, The Last Airbender, and The Legend of Korra while leaning over the coffee table with a soldering iron. And then I have Sam yelling at me like, you need to open the window because you're melting lead right now.
The two of you.
Yeah.
In Austin, it's kind of expected that you sniff or huff some kind of chemical if you live in the area.
I mean, yes, I also do resin, which you should be wearing a respirator for, which I do sometimes. And the funny thing was, when I first started doing resin, you couldn't find masks or respirators anywhere, because this was 2 weeks into lockdown. I ended up using... I have this like full face goggle mask. Like it covers your whole face so that you can like go scuba diving. I bought it for like going scuba diving in Puerto Rico, and it had a snorkel.
Quintessential pandemic memories.
And I think what I enjoy the most is that I think my friends and family are able to like, my friends and family seem to appreciate what I'm doing. And I've been asked by people like, can you, you know, will you make something for me to give as a gift for someone? I'm like, yes, yes, I would love to do that.
I love that. There's a great joy behind, here is this thing that I made for you. And no matter where my crafting sort of is in my life, if I'm in a big cross stitch kick, if I'm crocheting, if I'm painting, I love being able to say, I wanted to make this for you, and here I've done that.
Exactly. And that's it's that. And then not only that, but also when someone gets you something, they say, this made me think of you. That's just, and so that on top of it, I made this for you. It's just really sweet.
I don't know that Ian, your craft necessarily translate to that as well, because you're like, here is this thing that was $200 that I have spent time and money painting, but it's mine.
I've done something where, yes, it's still mine, but there is a sub-faction in the universe called Night Houses, where it's literally nobles piloting giant mechs. And so throughout the pandemic, I did a night house based on my immediate family. And each model has little details that, you know, style to each person. The weapon options are based on their personalities. So it's still all mine. But I can point to the model and say, hey, sis, this is you. And so where everyone else has a copper metallic on their venting and their guns, you are a vainglorious creature, and so you get gold. And my sister likes that, like, she's definitely the one in my family who likes to get dressed up the most, who likes to pay the most attention to her appearance. And so she likes that detail. And then my dad is a big, you know, his dad served in Patton's tank division. And so for his model, I have it standing across a tank, which he likes because it appeals to some of the history for him. And so each model can be personalized to the individual, and they're big enough that I can do those details for each person.
It sounds like The Sims, but war.
It kind of is. There's definitely, there are standards, and there are, like, normal stuff, but there is a huge ability to make it your dude. And so my paint scheme for my main army is my own. I have my own reasons for, like, why I lean so heavily on some colors and I avoid others. A good chunk of it is due to laziness.
It's a bitch to paint red.
Reds, yellows, whites, those are a pain in the ass to paint.
What makes one color more difficult than another?
So, because you're starting with gray plastic and you have to prime it, whatever your priming color is, that's your base color. And so a lot of times, black is the white base, the white coat from a Rattlekin is very chalky. It's not really good. And so you typically start with black. And to go from base black and then try to get up to white means you're doing gradients of gray and working your way up to that color. And I just don't have the patience for that shit. I don't.
Well, I think he's about to show off how detailed he can get.
So this army is not my main. It's called the... They use, like, a faux Latin that they... So, like, everything has a weird Latin-sounding name. And so these are the...
Yeah, it's a little green dude with an axe, and he's got the scythe that he has that same blue detail we were looking at before. Looks like a little energy axe. He kind of looks like
the Statue of Liberty fucked a Transformer.
Yeah. And so the army's name is the Adeptus Custodes. You know, a nice high-sounding name. But some people call them the custodes. And so I decided that my captain general, the head guy of the army, of the custodes, would be hopping mad and painted all green. And so, like, that's the kind of thing you can do with it, where it's like a meme and an in-joke, and then you base a painting scheme off that. And so it doesn't look that complicated, but that was actually a bit of work to figure out how am I going to make the metallic green and the cloth green stand apart and be visually different.
Well, yeah, because when you were showing it to us, absolutely, you still got an idea of, like, the depth of details. It's not like somebody took a spray can and was just like, it's green now.
Now, Ian, what do you use to clean your paintbrushes?
This is where I am a very bad hobbyist. I use water. Sometimes I use soap, and when they get bad enough, I just pay another $8 to get a new brush.
See, I do, like, the extent of my painting usually is just, like, paint by numbers, because I think that they're fun, and I am not a very, I'm not very good at translating what I see in my brain to, like, making my hand do it on paper, so paint by numbers is perfect for me. It's already in there, I just have to follow the lines vaguely. And the extent of my cleaning of those paintbrushes is I stick it in a cup of water with some dish soap. I swirl it around and then I run it out of the sink.
Okay, see, so.
But I'm just using acrylics.
Just whenever you're painting, you just, you know, lick the paintbrush so that it gets back into shape, and then you just slowly poison yourself as you go along painting.
That's literally what happened with the Radium Girls.
Listen, we are struggling as a hobby to, like, hey guys, when you're using aerosol primer, like a spray can, don't do that in an enclosed space, which I've done several times.
You guys are too young for whippets.
Honestly, we might be too old for whippets. We're not in high school anymore.
Be for yourself.
No, I just mean you've made several references to, like, Etsy was around when you left high school and you were leaving law school at the beginning of the pandemic, and just, like, reminding me that I am ancient compared to the two of you.
I graduated in 2019. Ian graduated in 2018, but we were born in the same year because Ian's smart and finished college a year early.
I'm also a middle school dropout.
Fun fact, and I got a bachelor's degree before I got a driver's license.
Whereas I crashed into the guy who was going to baptize me on the way to my baptism, and a few years later totaled my truck in a snowstorm, and then had to go to the same guy's house.
Keeping in mind that Ian's church baptizes when they're, like, 17. So it's not as though there was, like, tiny baby Ian driving this truck.
I mean, it was still kind of tiny, big, yeah, at 17 years old. Like, looking back at myself then, it's like, man, who let you make any decisions at all?
I still ask that about you, to be honest. And you represent people.
Well, here's the thing. I am very, very good at being representing others and taking care of other people. Taking care of myself is not a specialty, and especially by the time that I'm done, it's like 9 hours of taking care of other people's problems. I feel like lawyers in general have this. We take care of other people's shit for 9 hours a day. And by the time I get home, I got no time left for my own problems.
No, he just wants to sniff some glue. So this does lend itself to one of my questions was, you know, we do have very demanding jobs. It does take a lot out of us. How do you guys prioritize making time for this hobby that you find both relaxing and enjoyable?
So I'm appearing on another podcast, which is Lawyers and Jesus as our co-counsel, so I can say this. I turn Saturdays into a Sabbath day, which means I do no work. I eat out all day, which means I skip breakfast. And then I order out lunch and dinner. And I go down to the local hobby store, which I said, you know, I got into it because it was a wrong turn near my house, so it's nearby. And they have stools there, and I literally sit there and paint or sit there and play for 5-8 hours a day. And it's kind of like being at a local bar. It's kind of like Cheers. Everybody knows my name. I know everybody else. And we joke about it, but it's kind of like the corner bar without any of the alcohol content.
All right, so there's a community that you go and participate in, and you sort of made it part of your weekly ritual.
Right. And I mean, sometimes I'll paint during the week if I'm trying to get something ready for a tournament or an event. But I would say 80 to 90% of my painting and hobbying gets done sitting on a stool on Saturdays.
It's a little bit of both for me. So when I'm sitting in a meeting, I tend to try to do something to keep my hands busy. And when I was at my job, I had a big container of seed beads and a spool of fishing line. I'm like, I'm just going to keep my hands busy so that I can focus on what I'm supposed to be hearing. I also have processing disorder, so I need to try to, like, get all stimuli out in order to be able to listen. So just doing this mindless thing was something I was doing in meetings. And couple weeks later, this thing's probably like a couple feet long by now. It was 35 feet long. Because teeny little seed bead. And it's still in a box in my living room, and I have no idea what to do with it. And I noticed how much it calmed me during meetings that I wanted to be able to do it at the end of the day, creative energy, and to design things. So
you know, when I would finish the day, I would just go and look at my beads, and then I would, you know, arrange them on a table and be like, what do these patterns look like together? I could do this. I could do this. And then I finalize a design and I construct it. And I noticed that when I was getting set up to sell things, it made it more stressful because I was thinking that this won't sell. So I have to think, oh, I could totally see this friend liking this, or, you know, maybe I'll put these aside for my sister when she's a little older.
Interesting thing, because I've deliberately stayed away from being paid for hobby stuff. Like, I've had people, I've done some work on the side, which is I build things for somebody, but I don't paint them. I've had people, because I paint quickly, offer to like have me paint stuff for them just to get it like to a basic standard, but I go out of my way to not monetize my hobby.
I'm honestly, I'm the same way. Like, I've had people mention to me, because I make, like, little crochet, they're called amigurumi. It's, like, little crochet dolls that you can make. And I make blankets, too. And I've had people, and they're like, you should start an Etsy shop and sell this. One, do you know how much time goes into these? And that would just frustrate me to no end on what I would have to sell it for to feel like I'm making money because of the time and the... what actually goes into it. But two, I would just intellectually reject wanting to do it as soon as I had to for an order. Somebody would be like, can you make me a custom blanket? I'm like, fuck, okay, fine.
Start off for me as something that I would want to monetize. While I would love to just be able to make them, one, there's no need for me to own probably 300 pairs of earrings. Every four, like the same style. And I mean, I am in legal aid. It's not, if I'm spending the money to make these things because this makes me sane, I need to try to do what I can to make that back.
Come to private practice. Join the dark side. We have monies.
Absolutely fucking not. Just alone of having syllables, much less all of the time that goes into it. I admire you guys so much. I could not do it. There's a misconception about legal aid that everyone who does it is poor. No, that's not the case. We, at least with my employer and with what I found with legal aid organizations in Massachusetts, they, you know, they really do make sure that their employees are taken care of. So yeah, I might not make, you know, amazing money, but you know, my health insurance is free, for example. And T's like, I make good money. My whole health insurance is free. Sorry.
Well, my employer does give us extended health insurance too. So like my employer gives me vision and dental and like the certain amount per year for like massage therapy and like psychologist for actual therapy and things like that.
Okay.
Oh, come on. Who's the dentist?
Yeah. So, but I mean, I think everyone assumes that if you're in legal aid, you're just like flat broke, which I think is part of the reason why people are often turned off of the idea. But I know a number of people who make significantly more in legal aid than they do working for small private firms. So it's what I've always wanted to do. I didn't want to work in a firm. In fact, when I went to law school, my primary focus was domestic violence advocacy. So whether it's involved in a, being in a non-practicing position, doing like Title IX investigative work. And, you know, then I did an internship at a legal aid organization. Like, this is an option too, you know, public sector work. And especially since I'm drowning in student loans, the public service loan forgiveness is kind of a necessity for me. But yeah, also the health insurance. I mean, you guys know health insurance was so good, I eloped. So that's kind of why, you know, it's the money stress. That's, you know, getting back to things. It's sort of why I have to turn my mind off of things. Because I'm like, I'm making it work. It's fine. I'm just going to make pretty things and take deep breaths. And that'll help. So
how do you choose a project for your crafting when you learn? Approaching it and saying, I need to keep my hands busy. I need to do this new thing. How do you pick what you're going to do next?
I would say, so it's very hard to decide where to start. Like, oh, I have a hoop. I have a lever back. I have this. And I don't know where to start. I'm like, oh, do I pick the hoop? Do I pick the bead? And I get overwhelmed. So what I find I need to do is pick one thing, whether it's the bead that I'm doing, and then I go from there, or whether I decide this is going to be made with this metal. And it's not, so I improvise the design, but I won't improvise it as I'm making it. So what I tend to do is I'll line beads up together and see how those colors look together, and then move things around and play around with them. And then once I feel confident about it, then I'll put it on the hooks and seal it with the, you know, with the eye hooks. I use a lot of ultraviolet curing resin, which, Ian, I think you might like for your Warhammer projects. It's sort of like, it reminds me very much of, like, T, if you're putting an, Ian, you probably understand this too. I'm a bad feminist. When you're putting an outfit together, it's like, what am I basing this outfit around? Am I basing it around the shoes or this top or this dress? That's very much what it is with me designing jewelry. I pick one thing as my starting point, and then it kind of goes naturally.
Mm-hmm. I don't have to put outfits together because I cheat where everything is either blues or grays. And then I just pick jewel tone ties, and it just goes with whatever, you know, bland white shirt I'm wearing. So,
and I bet they all have adequate pockets and consistent sizing.
Do you mean the jacket I bought in my freshman year of high school that has pockets big enough for smartphones, even though smartphones didn't exist back then? Yes.
I hate you.
So because there's a game that's played with my hobby, I might get some hate from this. Go ahead, guys. I don't care. I look at whatever's strong in the game right now, and I build that because I'm going to want to play it. So there are websites that put out like stats for the game. They look at events that happened over the weekend, and they put out, you know, which list is winning, which armies are doing well, what units are those, like what models are those armies using. And then I'll just look and say, you know, I play the Space Wolves army. These lists are doing really well. These are the units they're using. Do I need any of those in my army, like in my roster, my backlog? And then I'll just buy them and build them. And I will just taste that meta.
That why would your gaming community frown upon that? Like, that sounds like a good strategy.
Because instead of being a labor of love where I care about the lore and my dudes and making it cool...
Oh.
I'm chasing that win percentage. I'm chasing, like, right now I'm building up that Adeptus Custodes army. It is one of two armies right now that has a win rate of over 70%, which you're supposed to be closer to 50 to 55, which means it's blatantly broken. And I got into it after it started doing that well because I saw how well it was doing, and I decided I want to get on that bandwagon. That bandwagon is a coming round, and Ian is hopping on it.
Does that make you the Warhammer version of a clout chaser?
Yes. Let me show you this thing. It is a giant gunship.
Cool.
Now that kit, to buy that,
yeah,
was $830.
What?
Because I do my budgeting on a every 4 week basis. And so every year there's an extra rent check and an extra student loan check. And so the student loan check goes to paying down student loans. And the rent check goes to really stupid bullshit that I just enjoy building and painting. Is how that works.
You know what? If you have a good way to budget your hobby, that's helpful. It's better than me, who sometimes I'm like, I have been asked to make X for a friend who's having a baby. I logged into the Michael website and suddenly I have spent $100.
I get it.
It's something that's rare for me in this hobby. Most people have what's called a pile of shame, where they buy things that look cool and then they never actually build and paint it.
Oh, every hobbyist. We won't talk about my fabric stash. I don't know how to sew.
There's definitely a pile of cross-stitch patterns hiding in one of these back here that I have not touched in years, like since before my daughter was born, because I've just been too fucking tired and I can't, like, see the pattern on the Ada to be able to do it properly, and I just gave up in my little pile of shame. Yep.
My backlog is nearly zero because I will paint before I buy new stuff.
I feel like that's the stubbornness in you coming out. Like, all of the things that you have been saying honestly reminds me of the fact that you were a litigator. And it's really funny because in the show notes that we put together, you put in the question about, you guys are litigators, how do you turn that competitive streak off? And I'm pretty sure the answer is that, Ian, you don't.
I don't at all. And it drives. Now, the cool thing is, because of the way I focus it, one, it means I paint up stuff. So an average army is 2,000 points, which is an arbitrary value assigned to models in the army. I've painted up about 17,000 points of one army, 4,000 points of another, 3,000 points of a third, and I'm getting close to 2,000 of a fourth. Don't really have a pile of shame. I work through things. And that's really nice for me. It means I get to throw a whole lot of shade at everyone else in the hobby. It also means that I meet people, like, I know people who, like, one of my friends, when I was getting into this hobby, he was buying a bunch of things all the time, and his wife finally said, honey, I love you, but you need to actually, like, get rid of some of this stuff. And so I picked up a bunch of stuff for like $50. Like, at that point, it was practically free. It was free
stuff. Was it like he had like kits that he hadn't built, or that he had built but he'd never painted?
Built but never painted. And so it was just standing there assembled. But he kept, it's called army hopping. You know, you get one project, then another project, then you keep finding some new cool thing to do. And I'm kind of a vulture where I'm like, I know some people who do that, and if I just sit here and wait patiently, eventually they're going to have to sell at a discount rate, and then I'll just pick that up. Like this thing.
It's like you're shorting the stock.
So, like, when I'm on the hyper-focus of every day after work, and I've had days where I come home, and I'm like, I'm just going to do, like, three paints and just make a little bit of progress. 11 p.m., I really need to go to sleep. Can I put the brush down? No, I'm doing so good. Just keep painting. Keep going.
I totally get that. I have that with some of my crochet projects too. I'm like, I'll sit in bed and I'll be like, I'm just going to listen to a podcast episode. Gonna do my thing. Let my hands do some work so that my anxiety comes down. And then I'm going to go to sleep. And it's like 3 hours later. I still want to keep going.
I made my brother and sister's Halloween costumes this year, and it involved, like, one of them, I took a laundry basket and I cut the bottom off, and I think I showed you guys. So
you did, yeah, you posted a picture in the Discord because I distinctly remember your family dog with the Doritos logo.
Doritos. And she was, it was a bag of spicy sweet chili, and she was spicy sweet Lily. And she did win the costume contest. I started it at 6 p.m. and ended up going to sleep at 4 a.m. And it was even worse a couple months later when I was setting up for the craft fair. I was just packing all the jewelry and making a couple extra things. This won't take long. 6 o'clock in the morning.
It's always the worst when you, like, want to be finishing a project, because I've had that happen with a couple blankets where I'm like, I am just going to finish the border and then it'll be done. And suddenly it's taken me 4 hours, mm-hmm. It's 3 a.m, mm-hmm. and I'm still not done because I keep finding a new stupid thing that I have to weave in.
And I think the difficult thing is that it took me until the age of 25 to realize that this is an ADHD thing. It's like, no, I'm in the zone. If I stop, then I have to get back into the zone at another point. And that's not guaranteed. It comes in just the form of bursts of inspiration. Do you understand what I mean?
There are times when I care about my hobby, and then there are times where 2 weeks can pass and I don't pick up a paintbrush, and I do not control when or what I care about when that happens.
Yep.
It just comes and goes. But as long as you don't see the sunrise from the bad side, that's fine.
That dopamine just comes and goes where it pleases.
I think this answers on whether or not Emily's competitive streak turns off, because I think it's the ADHD.
I mean, I guess define what you mean by competitive. Competitive and like, how do I turn my litigator self off?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because when I'm done at the end of the day, I've hit that capacity. I've always been the opposite of passive aggressive to a fault. And while I find that does serve me well as a litigator, I thought that like, oh yeah, no, this is how I am. It'll be fine. I never worked with opposing counsels until I was in this position. I had done basically going before courts in administrative capacities. American immigration courts are a whole thing. And it was more taxing than I expected. But the upside to that was it kind of forced me to be calmer and chill about things in my actual life. Because I know that if I get strung up, I'm not going to be able to turn it off. So I have to turn it off. I'm like, nope, you have to save the urge to get in your face for the person, you know, for the person who's trying to screw my client over.
I never run out of that urge.
You know, I thought that I wouldn't. And I do. I have it 40 hours a week. And then it's time to take naps and make sparkly stuff and pet my dog and my cat. Hi, Callie. You want to say hi?
So one of the things my job does, it doesn't do it now because the firm has changed its practice recently, but what's called civil commitments here in the UST, and a civil commitment is basically somebody gets brought in on a 72-hour psych hold, and then they get a 5-day period after the 3 days to basically lock them up and shoot them up with antipsychotic drugs.
And very often, those people might end up in the hospital where my mom works because she's a psych nurse. It's a shit show!
I love it! Because it's 5 days and it's negotiating with counsel, figuring out how sick they are, how am I going to argue the case. It's like the Wild West of lawyering. Like the truly absolute insane in front of a district court judge, you have no idea what's going to happen the day you show up kind of lawyering.
I took that
like a duck to water, and my boss was just like, are you okay? Because you want to do these. Most people who come to this firm like try to avoid them or push them off, and you're doing one like in the morning and then in the afternoon, and you're doing them 4 or 5 days a week, and I'm like, give me more. I like this craziness. I like the manic energy it takes to put this case together, to get it to trial, and then for 2 hours I'm slugging it out with opposing counsel. You know, opposing counsel is trying to keep their client free as a bird and that they can go out on the street and, you know, listen to the voices in their head, and I'm saying, no, Your Honor, we need to lock them up, throw away the key for 6 months and give them a bunch of drugs, even if they don't want to take them. And I never turn that energy off. That energy is just constant.
I've been meaning to ask you, but how do you keep it from weighing on you to just have it always on? It makes me physically exhausted.
So this is just me quoting my mother here. So take it with whatever grain of salt, cup of sugar you want. I thrive on chaos and conflict. To the point that if I was bored growing up, I would, according to her, have a look in my eye and she would banish me from the house. And so being a litigator where the chaos and conflict is just all over the place, I love it. And at my law firm, I have been called executioner, bulldog, cleaner, fixer. Like, I've kind of gotten a reputation for going into a messed up, broken case and somehow being able to get it back on track and get it going where it's supposed to go.
It kind of sounds like he's doing lawyer wet work.
There's an alternate universe in which he's a serial killer.
Yeah, absolutely there is. I do have one more question. Was how do you think
being a creative person with a craft, a hobby, how do you think that affects your life as a lawyer? Do you think it makes you better? Do you think that your lawyering affects the way that you approach your craft? How do those two parts of your life intersect?
I've started to get anxious. Like when I see, so I like to go to stores and if I see a piece of jewelry that I like, I'm like, no, I'm not going to buy that. I can make it. I'm like, wait, that IP theft? I would say part of it is, this is very specific, but when I make a piece that I really like, I want to show it off, but I actually very rarely get to wear a lot of the things that I make because they're all very glittery and like statement pieces and in your face. And it makes me wish that I can wear them in court and I can wear them in a more professional setting. So it sort of inspired me to create things that are statement pieces and creative, but also can be, you know, are professional. I was in mock trial in high school and
I'm such a nerd. I love it.
I'm probably the most predictable person there's ever been. And I, like, they were told, like, don't be wearing statement jewelry. You can only wear pearls or diamond studs. And for the longest time, I thought, if I'm in court, my hair either has to be perfectly flat ironed or it has to be into a bun. I don't think anyone notices that shit. The first time that I wore, I don't even remember what, like a necklace that wasn't made out of pearls, I felt like I was almost taking a risk of sorts. I mean, I would buy certain pieces of jewelry, like this is court jewelry. And I don't like pearls. I'm a flashy person. I like sparkles. And it's just like earrings and necklaces. But I think it's important that we redefine what a female attorney is supposed to look like. And I think that's I really love seeing that, like, in the Discord. Boston's super pretentious. You don't see as quite as much, but I've heard, you know, in other states, like, oh, this attorney has purple hair. No one cares. And I think at least in Boston, if we're going to start to edge toward that, jewelry would be the place to go. And it's also cool because legal aid tends to be a little artsier and more casual. So in my workplace, granted, I'm not in the office very much, you see people wearing all sorts of funky stuff. And I'm like, this is cool. I want to make more funky things. It gives me a way to express myself and go beyond that robotic box that attorneys are so often put into. I mean, even just, I wear a headband almost every day. It took me so long to be comfortable with that. Because I'm like, you're too old for a headband. I'm like, wait. I don't give a shit.
I probably will do a whole episode about the dubious double standards of clothing and fashion choices as female lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
But I totally hear you on there's little points of like starting to stretch your comfort zone outside of what was sort of indoctrinated into you of this is what a female lawyer is supposed to look like. So it makes me happy that the stuff that you make can help you do that.
Thank you.
Ian, how about you?
Typically don't bring my hobby to work. I mean, people know I do it and I'll tell them about it. But
does it go the other way for you though? Like, does it go that you kind of bring your career into the hobby?
I try very hard not to do that. Because then all I care about is winning. And all I care about is being right instead of having a good game and having a good time with other players. And so I can enjoy winning. I can bring the finesse and the technical accuracy of being a lawyer mm-hmm. to the hobby. But if I'm winning, you know, in the game, if somebody does something out of order, technically that's wrong. But as long as it doesn't affect anything, you just kind of let it go. Like, you're just being a good sport.
So there's no rules lawyering in Warhammer.
You're not supposed to. If someone calls you a rules lawyer, that's an insult. That's not a compliment.
I mean, if nothing else, do you find having good attention to detail must translate itself between the two?
Oh, it does, and it's great. But, you know, in attorney world, if somebody doesn't raise an affirmative defense, like, say, doctrine of estoppel, during their initial pleading, they've waived it. I'm not going to let them bring that up at the motion for summary judgment.
Don't fucking talk bar prep to me, dude.
What's terrible is I understood all of that.
Ew, and I don't want to anymore.
And so there's a part of me, and it's definitely, so I went to a big tournament. It was the first time this tournament was held down in Maryland. And so I flew there. And it's a 6-round event, and I got to round 6, and I've gone 3-2. And this final game is down to the wire. And this guy used a stratagem, a rule to pull a unit off the table, and then he could redeploy it the next turn, put it back on. But he forgot. So technically, that unit is destroyed. It was the last turn. He couldn't use it again. By every rule in the book, I could say, you can't put that on the table. Deal with it.
I mean, this honestly is giving me, like, civil procedure vibes. Like, oh yeah,
it is very the soft skills transfer very easily between the two.
That's cool.
I have to leave the attitude at home. But we weren't playing for money. Like, there was no money on the table. There wasn't even any pride. Like, we were playing for like 9th and 10th place out of 50 people. Like, it wasn't a big deal who won that game. And I had to take like 5 minutes just to wrestle with, okay, we had the time, obviously, but I was like, man, I do not want to give it to him. Every bit of sportsmanship says I give it to him, and every bit of law school and attorney thinking says, haha, sucks to be you. You forgot your own rules. Deal with it. And so I wrote an article for a website that got published. And in that article, I talked about that whole dilemma of sportsmanship versus following the rules. And I got some really negative feedback from the community. That people were saying, you know, oh, come on, man. How could you even have a problem with that? Or why is that a thing? Like, you should have just given to him. That's a no question. I'm like, guys, it literally came down to a 5-point swing out of 100 points. And me letting him put that on the table could have swung the game his way. Like, this wasn't a nothing, just give it to him. This was a real thing. And learning to leave the attorney at home is a thing for me.
That's making me think. So part of the reason why I find litigation to be so much more, I like it. I want to be clear. I like it, but I found it to be so much more difficult than I expected because I have this really unhealthy fear of not being liked. And there's no way to have everyone like you. It's just not possible. But
we haven't noticed that about you at all.
Whereas my default is, go ahead and hate me, you assholes. I'm going to win and be right, and that's what matters to me. So I love litigation.
I know this is unhealthy, and I know it's just like a deep-seated coping mechanism, but I am just so sensitive about not being liked and so afraid of like coming across as an asshole. I go out of my way to be sickly sweet to my opposing counsels. One, because what are you going to do? Say that someone was too nice? And also because I'm like, okay, listen, this is an inherently adversarial process. Why are we going to make it any more unpleasant to begin with? And that's also something I'm very sensitive to with my craft because I don't just like put things on strings. I try to make things that are beautiful and that I could see being sentimental to someone. And I put love and time and care into it. And obviously not everyone's going to like it, but I didn't anticipate being so sensitive about it. During lockdown, I got really into resin art, which is something that I'd wanted to do for a while, but was pretty intimidated by. I'm making 100 of these coasters, and they're meant to replicate opals. And I had posted about it on Reddit, and this particular subreddit, people are usually very nice. And some people were nice and others ripped me to shreds.
Over a coaster?
A lot of people make big money selling things on resin. And you see a lot of like figurines, coasters. I'm in the process of making
over 100 of these to be coasters and place cards, and I'm going to, you know, put people's name on it to make something special and personalized for them in the hope that maybe it'll be like, oh, this is something I can put in my office. I'm actually going to take this home. And I just posted it like, any suggestions? Like, what do you guys think so far? And people are like, a lot of them are like, I'm going to be honest with you. I would either leave it there or throw it in the trash. And others were saying, full of bubbles. Did you even hit this with a torch? I'm like, yeah, I hit it with a crème brûlée torch like you're supposed to.
I'd like to put a torch to that person's face.
And I didn't think it would bother me so much. Like, yeah, it's the internet. Like, I've already made 50 of these.
Okay, I can't tell you how many times, and this is just blaming attaching to real life. I have people in the hobby, in life, at my church, come up to me and say, hey, I need you to just kind of back me up on something. Because I need someone to help stiffen my spine as I go deal with this problem. I'm like, okay, here we go.
You like a hired gun?
Every single litigator is a hired gun, Emily. We're mercenaries.
Well, we're lawyers, so we could chat forever. Is there anything else that either of you wanted to add about your hobby, your crafting?
Yes, and this goes out to lawyers and anyone else with a high-stress and office-based job. You know, hobbies and crafts that come with a physical product at the end of the day give you a great serotonin boost. There is a physical thing. It's not a pleading to court. It's not an Excel spreadsheet. Having a physical product at the end is rewarding. And it's very nice when I feel like I have a week where I don't accomplish much. Like, I can be moving, working, doing research and all of that, which is good. But maybe I don't have any hearings or I don't have any, like, big products that come out of it. Being able to say, oh, yeah, and over the weekend, I painted this or I built this or helped a community have a productive conversation about the hobby, and all of those things can be like, oh yeah, wins. My advice to anyone is, if you're thinking about picking up a crafting hobby, give it a shot.
Nice. Emily, anything that you want to add at the end of the episode?
So I would second everything that Ian says. And what I would add is that this profession is so, in many ways, robotic. You know, everything is, of course, you know, by certain rules with these expectations, and then you do this, and then you do this, and then you do this. It's hard not to feel like just a cog in a machine. And it's so common to just feel like you're losing yourself and becoming just, you know, being a lawyer in many ways is very robotic. And it was important to me that not all of my creativity was used for the purpose of formulating arguments. Yes, that's crucial. But it's also a good reminder when I'm doing something that's creative, and especially when I end up with something tangible at the end, I'm like, wow, it's sort of like a left brain, right thing, where it's like, I have multifaceted things that I'm capable of. I mean, there's different forms of intelligence, and doing something that gives you creativity and can help you focus helps you realize the different types of intelligence that you have. Also, it's just a huge stress reliever. And we need that.
Ian is gesturing to his bottle of, I'm going to guess, scotch.
That's the Japanese whiskey that Harumi got me.
Ah, excellent.
That's a good stress reliever.
Yes, yeah, you have a glass of whiskey and a lot of crafting, and you're good to go.
And the risk of paint water versus whiskey is very real because they smell the same. And I don't know what you're drinking sometimes.
This is why when I am painting, I use a set of like little plastic colorful cups so that I do not confuse what is supposed to be paint, because I have heard so many stories of people drinking the paint water out of the coffee mug that, nope, never going to be me.
So I use a Tupperware thing for the paint water. The problem is when I was in undergrad, I used the exact same Tupperware to drink shots of rum. So,
yeah, so that's your nonsense brain and its problem.
You drink rum out of a food storage container?
Well, it was a dry campus, so I couldn't have a shot glass. And my dad told me that you should never drink straight out of the bottle.
So he's a goblin.
So technically, I followed all the rules of no whiskey glass, not out of the bottle. And so I followed the rules, but the result was doing shots of rum out of a Tupperware container at 1 a.m.
Plot twist, every single post on our malicious compliance was written by Ian.
We could do an episode of this with our malicious compliance, and it would just be me talking about all the times I followed every single rule that was laid down, and yet somehow was breaking every single rule. Like, I am the definition of, and I do it flagrantly. Like, I see the loopholes, and I'm just like, hi, rule authority, here's the loophole you left me. I'm going to go right through it, like this.
Are we going to school?